This is an ABC podcast.
Hi there, Edwina Farley with you for A Big Country on RN. This week we go digging in the Pilbara, not in a huge iron ore mine, but in a cave frequented by Indigenous people thousands of years ago. We'll get inspired in Steve and Marika Hancock's garden. They've turned some pretty marginal country in far north Queensland into a botanical wonderland. Exciting times too for a couple in Victoria's Alpine region. After 8 long years, the first truffles are appearing on their oak trees. And you'll get to meet a young up-and-coming music star. Rory Phillips is just 11 years old, but already has his sights set on a career in the music industry.
It's obviously my passion. You know, it doesn't come naturally, but if you put in the work, you end up with a pretty good end product.
What a cracker. So lovely to hear such wise words from someone so young. Rory's story coming up, but let's start our travels in the West on an archaeological dig in the Pilbara.
Well, right here, Steve's excavating an in-situ hearth. So it's the remains of a campfire, possibly around 20,000 years ago. So you can imagine that Aboriginal people would have been sitting around on that lower level there, which is an ancient land surface. And they had a little fire here.
Archaeologist Dr. Michael Slack is getting pretty excited. He's watching on as one of his team carefully scrapes away at an ancient campfire. It's evidence that Indigenous people used this cave site thousands of years ago.
So the guys this morning have just uncovered a really ancient campfire that, given the depth below the surface and the relationship with the stones around it, we think it's potentially around 20,000 years old, which is really exciting.
Hello, I'm Karen Mitchell-Moore. I'm at an archaeological dig in Western Australia's remote Pilbara region. We're in the Hamersley Ranges, to the east of the mining town of Newman, an area that's famous for its huge iron ore deposits. The fire site they're unearthing today is on a much smaller scale.
So it consists of about, 20 or 30 centimetres of really white fine ash. You can clearly see that it was a campfire. And in the middle of it were little pieces of charcoal that we've been able to collect, and we'll send them off for radiocarbon dating. And just after that, to make it even better, they found flake stone artefacts right next to the charcoal. So we'll get a really good association between people and the campfire itself. So we'll have a really good, clear idea of how old it is.
And the flake stone artefacts is like the cutting instruments for cutting up the meat, I'm assuming.
Possibly. We'll have to have a look at them under the microscope. But yeah, they're the pieces that people were using in the site, yeah.
So this could have been an ancient barbecue setting that you've uncovered.
Definitely something was going on that was a lot of fun. The family sitting around a campfire having a meal probably, yeah.
Archaeologists like Michael Slack have been working with mining companies and traditional owners to uncover, analyse and date the artefacts they find at sites like these. The results are giving an insight into what Aboriginal people were doing in the area over the last 30,000 years or so.
We're excavating a really exciting site that we came to a couple of years ago. It's a cave that dates back at least 31,000 years before present, and maybe even older. We're extending our area that we're excavated before to try and get down deeper and try to recover more evidence of the past.
And so how was this site discovered?
It was discovered through surveys conducted for sort of compliance work for BHP Billiton, but found by a survey party. So Aboriginal people, the local traditional owners, working with archaeologists and walking around basically on a grid pattern, discovered this probably about 10 years ago, I'd say. Originally, we came out about 2 years ago and did what we call a test pit, which is a one-by-one area, like a square in the ground. We chose what we thought was probably the deepest part of the site. And what we're doing now is extending that area out to see how much further down the site goes and how potentially older it is, and reconstructing, be able to talk a lot more about what had been happening over the many thousands of years as a result.
Using garden trowels, the team carefully scrapes away the dirt. It's a slow process. Everything is placed in buckets before being taken outside to be weighed and sifted through.
What's going on is that we're excavating the square. So we've got two archaeologists in there, and one's carefully sort of removing a little bit of soil at a time. like just a couple of centimetres at a time, with a little tiny garden trowel, and looking carefully, looking through for chips of stone artifacts, little pieces of charcoal, and anything else that might appear in that sediment.
So is everything that's dug out put in one of these buckets? And there's lots of buckets around, isn't there?
That's right. There's an awful lot of buckets. Archaeologists are really good to hardware stores in terms of buying buckets. So if people are going to their local hardware store and there's no buckets, you know that there's a dig on nearby.
Let's just bag it up rather than sieve it. Okay. We'll just do it under small sieves and just see if we get anything out of it later on in the lab, yeah?
So the buckets are filled up, and then the next process is that we take those buckets down, we weigh them, we look at the volume of material that's coming out of each one of those levels and carefully mapping that, and we'll also process that material. So what we do after with the buckets, we don't throw them away, because even though we're awesome at digging, we're going to miss things, right? There are little tiny flakes, little tiny artifacts that are 1 to 2 millimeters in size, and they need to be found as well, because they'll tell us a lot about how things were being chipped as well.
Helping out at the dig site is archaeologist Stephanie Vick. She's particularly interested in the stone artifacts they're uncovering.
I'm a bit of a rock nerd, so my favourite thing is definitely lithics. I really love little backed artefacts and all sorts of cutting implements that they make out of stone.
And what is it about rocks that you love?
I think, as well as I find a certain beauty in them, a big thing for me is when I'm analysing stone and I can work out how someone was working the piece of stone and reducing it down to make a tool, it's a bit of a connection with someone in the past. They spent time sitting there making that tool. It's one moment in time, and then tens of thousands of years later, here I am being able to recreate that. It's, you know, you feel a connection to the person that was sitting there making that particular tool, and that's pretty special to me, I think.
It's early days yet, but Dr. Michael Slack believes this cave was an important stopping off point for Aborigines in the region. All the signs point to it being a well-used shelter.
We'll know a lot more when we finish digging, but we can definitely say it's a place where people came and took shelter and maintained tools. So we can see lots of chips of bits and pieces that people were, you know, maybe maintaining hunting implements. We can see that people were eating here, because we found lots of pieces of kangaroo bone. We found evidence of campfires as well. So, I mean, you can imagine this small cave would have held maybe 8 or 10 people, perhaps a little family group coming here every few years and knew about it. It's a perfect spot. It's got great views. You catch the afternoon shade in the Pilbara is very important in sort of summer season in particular. So you can imagine a family group camping from time to time in this spot.
It's an attempt to demonstrate the potential of marginal country.
Steve and Marika Hancock certainly don't shy away from challenge. In dry, sandy country filled with straggly gums and wattles in far north Queensland, they've created a botanical wonderland. A lush rainforest exists outside their kitchen window.
This country here is fairly marginal in that even though we're only 60 kilometres away from the wettest part of the whole continent, we're here in an area where we get less than a metre rainfall, whereas over there on Billancourt they get 8 metres.
Hello, I'm Fiona Sewell. Through sheer hard work and determination, the Hancocks have transformed this block of land at Watsonville, a small town southwest of Cairns. They've called their garden Back to the Bone. It's living proof that even in so-called marginal country, you can get anything to grow.
The soil here has gone. We're down to decomposed granite sand through mining, logging and denuding of the country. That's what it's come back to. We're trying to demonstrate here that this country does have potential if you, you know, make the right moves as far as soil building, arresting the drainage and putting organic material back into the soil so it's actually capable of growing something.
It also sounds like you created a lot more work for yourselves by choosing a property that was on, as you say, marginal country.
Yeah, that's true. If we'd have settled on the Atherton Tablelands, there wouldn't have been any work to do.
You know, when we bought this place and we start planting, and so all the time to us, oh, it's a waste of time, you guys, you planting things and it all die. it all died.
So it's obviously has worked. Just looking out your kitchen window here, and we'll take a walk in just a moment, you've got stuff growing everywhere. And Marika, I know you spent many years living in Costa Rica. I can see lots of tropical plants. Does it remind you of your life there?
Well, that's also what Steve tried to do in the beginning, to let me feel more home.
I look out your other window there, and that's pretty much what is on the rest of the country. Can you just describe that?
Well, looking out the back door, we're looking at dry sclerophyll, and which is largely dominated by eucalypts, the main one being lemon-scented gum. There's yellow stringy bark, bloodwoods. Then there's a few species of wattle and granite boulders.
And you certainly didn't clear any of that, so you've kind of planted between all of those things.
Yeah, we used the existing forest as pioneers and then planted the colonisers in between them.
Well, shall we go have a look?
Sure.
Just pop that on. Wow, and you walk into this like grove you've created and instantly temperature change.
Yeah, there's probably 3 or 4, even 5 degree temperature drop coming out of the sun and into here.
Palm Gully. Wow, this really is tropical.
This is a Chinese fan palm.
Now I feel like I'm in a rainforest. In Watsonville.
Yes, well that palm there is from one of the wettest parts of Australia as well. That's a Mission Beach fan palm. And this little palm over here, this is a Darwin palm.
Mm-hmm. That's lovely. So how big is the garden that you've created here?
It's around about 5 or 6 acres, I think.
So you've got some fruit trees growing in here too, Steve?
Yes,
down here?
Basin down here, which is a shallow depression which I've created for the purpose of collecting water and leaf litter and enriching the soil. We've got it planted with tropical fruit trees such as carambola, lychee, longan, green star apple, and then just for aesthetic reasons we've got it interspersed with palm trees. This is a Costa Rican palm.
You like that one, Costa Rican palm?
Yes.
Yeah, this is a savannah palm, and I put this in specifically for Marika to make her feel at home. There are a few others.
So it's been a 21-year horticultural experiment then?
Sure, yeah. Well, you can't go wrong, see? The operative word is experiment, so there's no right or wrong. It's, as a rainforest, this and as a wildlife habitat, this forest achieved success after only 9 years. I was trying to create a habitat for tree kangaroos. Mm. And after 9 years of planting their food plants, we got a tree kangaroo here.
Really?
Mm. Yeah. So I'm hoping he finds a mate and brings her back, you know.
Yeah. Nature is truly amazing.
You get a lot of surprises, you know. There's things coming up, you don't even know what they are half the time.
Well, I guess that's the fun, the excitement of it.
That's part
it?
Of the fun, yeah.
It's an amazing garden you've created here, so thanks so much for showing me around.
Oh, you're welcome. Well, we love showing people around. That's what we do.
Love it. It's wonderful.
And make sure to visit Steve and Marika Hancock's garden if you're passing through the Herberton District in far north Queensland. Sounds like they love showing people around. You're listening to A Big Country. Coming up, truffle hunting in Victoria's Alpine region with a golden retriever called Charlie. And young Rory Phillips is following his dream.
So this one I thought I'd start off with because it's pretty much my life story. And because I'm only 11, that means it goes for 3 minutes 15 seconds. Cars and guitars.
While most 11-year-old primary school kids are busy with homework, sleepovers and weekend sport, Rory Phillips is usually performing at music festivals. Hello, I'm Rosie King. This talented young musician from the small Riverina town of Tumut in southern New South Wales has his heart set on a career in the music industry.
Oh, it's taken me a lot of places over the past sort of 4 years. You know, Blues Fest, Tamworth,
you know, supporting amazing people all around the country. You know, I've been to places as far as Melbourne and Sydney, and even further north of that, I've been up to Byron and, you know, everywhere pretty much.
And with him, every step of the way is his mum, Sam.
And when you say we, I assume you're talking about you and your very, very dedicated mum.
Oh, yes.
Tell me about your mum.
So, my mum, ever since day one, has been, you know, so supportive, and she's my chauffeur, she's my manager, she's my roadie, she does everything. And without her, you know, I wouldn't be able to do it. I think I was sort of just born to do what I do, but there was definitely a lot of work involved to get where I am, you know. It's obviously my passion, you know, it doesn't come naturally, but if you put in the work, you end up with a pretty good end product.
Does it feel like work?
Not really. It sort of feels like work in the sense that, you know, like there is an end product and you know you're better than when you started, but it doesn't feel like, oh, I have to do this, you know. You do it because it's a passion.
It's that commitment that Rory's mentor thinks will give him an edge when it comes to making the big time. Roger Corbett is a member of the Bushwhackers band and produced Rory's EP, Cars and Guitars. He's also the general manager of the Australian Academy of Country Music.
He's an extraordinary person, as you probably realise, because he's kind of like an old soul. He's got this old head on his young shoulders. He can play guitar pretty amazingly, and he's got this sort of encyclopedic knowledge of music. The ones who succeed are the ones who want to succeed, and the ones who are truly dedicated to their own world and really want it and really work hard tend to kick along, and it's not always the most talented ones, but it's definitely the ones who want it the most. And it's true of anything you do in life. If you want it, you'll make it happen for yourself.
He's from Tumut, which is a tiny town in southern New South Wales. How do you think that will impact his career progression?
You know, you've got to come from somewhere, and in some ways having a kind of a country town background doesn't hurt you, because it keeps you kind of grounded and gives you a little bit of perspective on the big bright city lights. I think Rory's that passionate about it that I think he'll make it happen for himself.
Of course, Rory's mum Sam would love to see her young son make his mark in the music industry, but she really just wants him to be happy.
If he's successful, that would be great. If he's really successful and can take care of his mother and his dad, that'd be even better. But I really hope, you know, he just loves music so much and is so passionate about it. I hope that he can find a career where he's not a struggling musician, you know, that he can make enough money out of it. Whether he ever hits the big time or not, I don't know. But yeah, if he can make enough money out of it to be doing what he loves, then he's already better off than probably 90% of the population that are stuck in, you know, doing jobs that they don't enjoy. As long as he's happy, that's the main thing.
And what's your end goal?
What's my end goal? You know, making enough money to get by playing music. I don't want to end up with a day job. Yeah, I don't know how possible that is, but I think that's my aspiration. Whether it's possible or not, that's a different thing.
What do you think it takes?
Oh, a lot of practice, a lot of hard work, you know. Not everything gets put on a silver platter and they say, there you go, here's a record deal, you know. It's hard work, but I think I can do it.
Charlie, what are you doing?
So she's just actually gone through, and as we're speaking, trying to look for a truffle.
Charlie, what's over here? What's here?
Charlie is an enthusiastic young golden retriever with a newfound nose for truffles. She's working hard in this orchard near Bright in northeast Victoria with her owner, Taola Baldwin.
So we can't actually call Charlie a truffle dog because she's not 100% trained. She's just a very excitable pup. She's still 3 years old, so golden retrievers take a little while to mature.
Hello, I'm Megan Ruth. Charlie might be new to truffle hunting, but she's already proved her worth. After 8 years patiently waiting for these inoculated oak trees to mature, the Baldwins, with the help of Charlie, have found their first truffles.
We were blowing off last year's leaves. We had got to nearly the end of the row and Charlie was getting a little bit bored, so she decided to dig a hole. And as I got to the end of the row and I was a little grumpy at Charlie for digging the hole, so as I went to cover in the hole that she had dug, out popped a truffle.
For Tayola, it was definitely a moment to celebrate.
Mark had gone back to get the lawnmower and I was doing this crazy dance back to him, and he thought I'd seen a snake or something, because that's the sort of movement I do when I'm really crazy. And as he came up, you know, the excitement was, we've done it. That's all it was, is the fact that we'd done it.
The truffle find was not only a significant moment for the Baldwins, but also the Ovens Valley. This area around Bright used to be a tobacco growing region until the industry was closed down back in 2006.
People in the valley had looked to bring something new to the valley after the tobacco had ceased, and it was sort of doubted that the valley could actually handle it and actually produce truffles. So it was the first thing that, you know, we had done it. It was, we'd been the first to do it and we'd persevered with it and we did it.
While Tayola and Mark are new to truffles, they are also relatively new to northeast Victoria. They packed up their life back in Perth in 2010 after falling in love with this place while on a skiing trip to nearby Mount Hotham.
We went skiing and came back and thought, this is a pretty nice place to be. We love winter. We love the cold. We, like everybody else, just wanted a small plot, 5 acres on the river with a mountain. And we definitely got that, but we got 40 acres instead.
With a block of land to play with, the Baldwins decided to try their luck with truffles. The industry was already gaining momentum in their home state of Western Australia, and they thought they'd do well here too.
Truffles were something that was a little unknown. Manjimup was very big in the truffle industry. They started around that sort of time that we were looking, and then when we looked into it a little bit further, we found that we're at the same latitude south as France are north from the equator. So everything started to add up. We had the summer rains and we had the winter frosts. So they were things that the truffles needed to grow. We just didn't have lime over here, which they have in Western Australia. So we had to add quite a bit of lime and dolomite to bring our pH levels up. And now we've found it works.
So from 2010 until now, has there been any times that you've doubted yourself or you've thought, what have we done?
We've tried to stay positive the whole time through. We knew that we had done everything we could to manipulate the soil. Every tree has a sprinkler. So even though the industry is still very new, deep down we knew we were doing the right things to give it every possibility, chance of actually working.
With the truffle starting to appear, the Baldwins are keen to sample the product. They like to think of it as quality control.
Mark is very fond of it, so the first few that came out of the ground went onto eggs, went onto steak, went onto anything basically Mark was eating that was warm. So truffle needs, it needs fat. So i.e. butters or eggs or something it's got a bit of fat, but it also needs the heat to release the flavour.
While it's early days for this truffle orchard, the Baldwins are already looking ahead. They've planted more trees and hope to supply local restaurants as yields improve.
It's still very new. We are still, you know, we've got 400 trees that are 8 years old. We've got another 400 trees that we planted last year. And we just don't know what sort of quantities we're going to get. You know, we've got 800 grams out of the ground, which really for 400 trees is not a lot. But for us, it's a great start. So each year we will improve and increase. We're still very early in the season. The fruit hasn't actually come to harvest. It hasn't ripened to its full capacity yet. So we've still got hopefully we've still got a bit more to harvest this year, and then each year hopefully we grow on it.
How about Charlie? What's next for her?
Charlie needs a lot more training. Charlie needs to grow up a little bit because she's still a puppy. But she's coming along really well. She's
our baby.
Yes.
And let's hope Charlie, the enthusiastic young golden retriever, continues to unearth those truffles for her owner, Taola Baldwin. Megan Ruth with that story from Bright in Victoria's Alpine region. That's the program for this week. Thanks to Ari Gross for technical production. RN has some of the best podcasts on offer in the country, if we do say so ourselves. So check them out, including this one, via the ABC Listen app. I'm Edwina Farley. Bye for now.